like I'm juggling invisible balls. It was not altogether unpleasant. Sims snorts, a ringing endorsement of kissing. It didn't make me hear violins or go weak in the knees or want to do any more than that, which I think is the evolutionary point of the kiss. It's just a thing people do. I feel strange suddenly. The old itch of fear that I am a feral girl in a domesticated world, watched by everyone with pity and concern. There are men like Monty, with perverse desires, but they find each other and carve out small corners of the world, and likely women too, who find themselves only drawn to the fairer sex. And then there's me, an island all my own, an island that sometimes feels like a whole continent to rule, and sometimes a cramped spit of land that sailors are marooned upon and left to die. Sim is staring at me. No pity or concern, but those enormous eyes reduce me to hand-flapping and a half-apologetic, half-frantic, I don't know, perhaps my mouth doesn't work.
Of course your mouth works.
It's dark enough, in only the light of the Talon moon, that I almost don't realise she's moved until I feel her hand upon my cheek. And when I turn to meet her, she presses her lips against mine. It is entirely different from kissing Callum. It is, for a start, significantly less wet, less impulsive and frantic and out of control. It feels bold and shy both at once, like giving and taking. Her lips are chapped, but her mouth is soft as milkweed silk and rimmed with salt water from the cold spray kicked up against the side of the boat. When they part against mine, I open my mouth in return. Her thumb skims my jawline, feather light. But beyond the physical observations, it's nothing. Not wholly unpleasant, but neither something I'm anxious to repeat. Just a thing people do. She pulls back, her hand still upon my cheek, and looks at me.
Did that work any sort of magic?
Not really.
That's a shame.
She settles back into our little nest of cloaks, pulling the collar higher around her face.
It worked for me.
Algiers. 17. Algiers sits upon the crook of an iridescent bay. Even in the weak sunlight as our ferry makes its slow progress against the dawn, the buildings sparkle like they're inlaid with precious stones, the white sand beach a jewellery box to house them. The city makes a slow climb up the hillside, flat-roofed and whitewashed, with the bony fingers of minarets poking out. Clouds stretch across the horizon in wispy streaks. Joanna and I, pasty English girls in very European clothes who speak no useful languages here, stick out sorely. I've heard a great deal of renegades have come from Europe to seek asylum in Algiers from whatever trouble drove them off the continent, but we look far from criminals. It is positively unfair how unrumpled Joanna manages to look after weeks upon the road. Somehow, she's kept her skirt pressed, likely something to do with the loving layout she gives it each night, no matter where we are staying, while I am more inclined to step out of mine and then let it lie in a puddle upon the floor so that I can sooner fall into bed. The plan is to hire camels, then ride to a garrison of Sim's father's men, several towns from Algiers. From there, we'll go to the Crown and Cleaver Fortress. Sim leads the way through the city with a confident stride. I expected that here we might see a different version of her, relaxed and at ease so near to her home. But instead, she seems tense. She keeps pulling on her headscarf, fiddling absently with the knot holding it in place. My own hair feels exposed in contrast to the veiled women in the city. Joanna and I aren't the only bare-headed women, or the only ones with fair skin.
but something about the concentration of both, so much lower than I'm used to, makes me feel very obvious. As well-travelled and hard to shock as I pride myself on being, I realise when I meet the eyes of a woman across the road and she stares at me, that I know nothing about this world. We stop for breakfast in the Medina, a market made up of tapered streets rendered smaller by vendors' wares jutting into the footpaths. Men lead donkeys by the nose, their backs laden with woven baskets and their hooves clapping against the stones. The air is hazy with the smoke from cook fires where women roast rabbits spattered in vivid sprays of saffron. The street tips upward into long cracked steps. Tiled mosaics and alcoves interrupt the shop fronts, studded with sea glass and scripture painted on ceramic. Joanna is rapturous, wandering through the haze like she has been transported into a fantastical dream. If she shares any of my discomfort of being a stranger in a strange land, she doesn't show it. The sun streams through the awnings and splinters over her face, threading her hair with gold as she lets her fingers press into the inlaid tesseracts along the walls. She stops at a stand with emerald birds lined up like soldiers, their feet knotted to their perch, and has to stroke the domed feathers of each of their heads. Sim whistles at her to get her walking again, and all the birds whistle in reply. "Are you all right?" I ask Sim, as I struggle to keep up with her quick stride, Joanna traipsing happily behind us. "Fine," she replies, though that strong jawline is jutting out. "Are you certain? You seem tense." "Of course I'm tense. I've got you and Miss Hoffman. Keep up!" she calls over her shoulder at Joanna, who has stopped to feed the rest of her breakfast to a stray dog lounging on the stoop outside a mosque. "The two of you don't blend in well." "That's not our fault. Doesn't change the fact that we're easy to spot." "And you think someone's trying to spot us?" She glances over at me, so quick it's almost lost in the folds of her scarf. A parrot squawks right in my ear, and I swat without thinking. It nips at me, and I yelp, turning to glare at whatever negligent shopkeeper is failing to monitor their fowl. The woman is sitting on the ground, in front of a blanket spread with varying bottles and amulets and medicinal-looking charms. Amid the jumble laid out upon her cloth, a flash of blue catches my eye. I pull up short. Joanna crashes into me, and a woman behind us, carrying two wicker baskets, almost smashes into both of us. Sim stops when the woman curses loudly. In spite of the unfamiliar language, it's very easy to distinguish a curse, and turns back to us. "What is... Sim, look!" I point down to the blanket, where six blue scales the size of my palm wink back at us. Sim comes to my side, Joanna on my other. The shopkeeper's face is completely covered by her veil, but through the slit in the material, her eyes dart between us.
"She shouldn't have those," Sim says. "It's illegal in my father's territories to own or sell the dragon scales, or use them, or hunt the sea monsters to get them."
She steps forward, crouches down on the balls of her feet so she can address the shopkeeper in Darija. Joanna and I stand behind her, helpless and dumb. As she speaks, Sim jerks up her sleeve to show the woman her ink, and the woman shies. "Don't frighten her," I say to Sim.
"I'm not," she replies in English, without looking at me. "She's frightened because she's done wrong and she knows it."
She picks up in her native language again, and the woman squeaks back a few words in reply.
"What is it?"
Joanna asks, as Sim stands and faces us again. The woman has her hands clasped before her in penance, her shoulders shaking. Sim knots her fingers behind her neck, staring down at the scales on the woman's blanket, then up at the sky. I can hear her grinding her teeth.
"We need to delay finding my father's men."
"What?" I say. "Why?
What did that woman tell you?
She told me where the scales came from, just outside the city.
Sim holds up a hand to shield her eyes from the sun as she turns to us.
There's a dragon washed up on the beach.
Beyond Algiers, we follow a rough road that snakes through the countryside for almost an hour. Every step drops handfuls of sand down the backs of my boots. The houses turn to farms, then the flat terrain to a rough hike up a hillside of loose soil and scrub. All three of us lose our footing more than once when the soft earth gives out from under us. As we climb, the air grows thick with the smell of a beach and something decomposing upon it. Joanna and I both pull the collars of our dresses up over our mouths. Sim covers hers with her headscarf. When we crest the hill, Joanna gasps. I have to hold my hand up to shield my eyes from the sun before I see it too. Below us is a horseshoe inlet, hidden from the open water by cliffs. The sickle of white sand is framed by that radiant blue water and thick patches of greenery. And washed up on the beach, still half in the waves so that the surf froths with blood, is a dragon. By my best estimation, it's likely over 100 feet long, though I can't be sure from its haphazard sprawl and its tail disappearing into the water. It resembles most closely the serpents from Sybil Glass's drawings in the cabinet. It has a long body, the same sparkling blue of the sea, though the scales have been diluted by sand and blood. The armoured forehead narrows into a pointed snout, with what looks like antennae sprouting from it like kelp snagged upon its eyebrows. There is a scattering of people on the beach, most clustered around the creature and picking at it with axes or knives, prying scales away and carving handfuls of the doughy flesh beneath. Some have even brought ladders and wagons along to aid with their take. A boy, who can't be more than 10, is sitting upon the head, trying to hack off the tips of the antennae.
"Bloody scavengers," Sim hisses. "They cut up the corpses and sell the scales as a drug and everything else as sham remedies.
The fat for clear skin and silky hair, spine bones as lucky charms."
"Vertebrae," I say.
"What?"
"The spine bones," I reply, my eyes still on the creature. "They're called vertebrae."
"Thank you, but that's not what I'm concerned about right now."
"If you're going to say something, at least say it right." Her hands flex into fists at her side.
"These rats are going to strip this corpse, flood the markets in Algiers, and then sell the runoff in Nice and Marseille. Your Dr. Platt won't be the only one looking for dragons."
"What do we do?" I ask.
"I have to fetch my father's men," Sim replies. "We drive the scavengers away when this happens, and keep watch over the corpse until the tide takes it back. I'm going to run to the garrison and bring them back."
"I want to stay here," Joanna says.
"Why do you want to stay with a rotting monster?" Sim asks.
"Because I've never seen one before," Joanna says, "and I'd like to have a proper look."
"That seems ill-advised. You can wait for me in Algiers."
She looks to me for reinforcement. "I'd rather stay here too," I say. Even dirtied by the sand, those scales in the light are like liquid sapphires.
"Please, you don't need us," Joanna says to Sim,
like we're children begging our mother for one more slice of cake. "We'll probably just raise more questions with your father's men, and you'll travel faster alone." Sim curses under her breath.
"Fine, but stay up here. Don't go down to the beach. I say that knowing neither of you will heed me, but these people are leeches."
She jerks her chin down at the beach.
"Don't try to take anything. If anyone starts to scold you or shout at you or pulls a knife, just run. They want to scare you away from their salvage. It's not a joke,"
she says when Joanna giggles, though I imagine it's more from the delight at seeing the monster than at Sim's words.
"This isn't a romp with your dog in the garden."
Max and I don't romp in the garden, Joanna replies. It dirties his paws.
People have died for much less than one dragon scale. Sim presses her hands flat against her lips, then says, I'll be back by nightfall. If I'm not, sleep here tonight, and then go back to the city in the daylight. The boars and foxes hunt along the road after dark, and they won't want a cuddle, she says.
For Joanna looks absolutely swoony with delight at the prospect of animal friends. Anything else, Mother? I say. Sim purses her lips, so hard her skin mottles.
Here.
She reaches down into her boot, pulls out her marlin spike, and hands it to me.
Don't do anything stupid, she says, then takes off at a run back down the hillside.
As soon as Sim is out of sight, Joanna turns to me, her hands clasped before her.
We are not staying up here.
Obviously. She squeaks in delight, bouncing toward me on the balls of her feet.
And here I thought I might have to fight you for agreement. You're such a rascal, Felicity, and I do love it. Come on!
We stagger down the cliffside path and emerge on the beach, our feet leaving pulsing halos in the damp sand as we approach the dragon corpse. One half-open eye stares sightless at us, the glassy pupils slit. A thin, forked tongue spills from between its teeth.
It's like a snake, Joanna says, hiking her skirts up as she bounds down the sand toward it. An enormous snake that lives in the ocean. How does it breathe underwater?
Does it breathe underwater? I ask. There's a wound in its side, between the soft flaps around its neck. Not gills, but vulnerable enough that something was able to dig its way in and tear up the flesh like the ground after a tree is uprooted. Maybe it's the wound that killed it.
There are no gills. Maybe they're hidden, she says. Or maybe they breathe like frogs through their skin.
Is that true? Or is this revenge for telling you ears regrow?
It's the truth. Don't you remember the toads that swam in the pond on the Peels' grounds?
I don't remember them breathing through their skin.
And if they really are like snakes, they must have a more effective means of regulating the salt concentration of their blood, or...
She steps up close to the mouth, the jaws as wide as she is tall, and peers fearlessly into it, steadying herself against one of the teeth as long as her hand.
Filters around the tongue?
I walk along the side of the serpent, watching the way the scales reflect the light like water. Birds are perched upon the spine, picking at the scales to get to the soft meat below. I test one of the scales in my hand. Even with decay, they don't split easily. In spite of Sim's warning, I tug at it. It resists, so I use the marlin spike. Even with the metal as a lever, it takes a lot of prying before it cracks off in my hand. I fish my spectacles from my pocket and press them to my nose. Up close and whole, the scale is the shape of a corn kernel, round and tapered where it connects to the body. The colour looks more pearly and reflective than it does when ground down into that sapphire powder. I don't know how powerful the scales truly are, so I press it against my tongue with a light hand. It tastes of brine, though perhaps that's just the residue of the sea, along with something like bone. Is it bone? Are they bones and not scales? What creature wears its bones outside its body? I break off a piece of the scale the size of my thumbnail, press it to my tongue, and let it dissolve. When I swallow, it prickles the back of my throat, a bubbly, bright feeling that turns my senses to champagne. I know it is fast acting, so I wait, wondering if I've even taken enough to feel any sort of kick or lift or difference at all. And then I stop wondering. It's like the world sharpens. The colours become brighter, the sound louder.
I can hear two men down the beach arguing in Darija, every word clear, though I don't understand them. I feel like I could learn it. I look down at the scale in my hand, and my vision blurs. It takes me a moment to realize it's my spectacles. When I push them up on my forehead, the eyesight I lost long ago from squinting at tiny print in poor light has returned. I take a breath, and it's like chambers inside my lungs that I never knew existed open, letting so much air flood me I fear I will float away. I'm not sure if it's real or simply my perception, but I swear my heart has never beat with strength like this. It's not fast with fear or ragged like after running. It's strong. It makes me feel strong. I wish I had a book. I could read it at twice my usual speed. I wish I had a problem to solve, something mathematical and complicated, with a right answer. I flex my fingers in and out of fists, trying to decide if I want to run or swim or start listing every word I know. My heart begins to feel like it's beating too fast. My whole body feels too fast, and at this speed, even a prickle of fear feels like panic. When it leaves me, it's abrupt, like picking up a box you expect to be heavy and finding it weightless. The first thing I think, it comes to me without my consent, is that I will never truly breathe deeply again. I'll spend the rest of my life feeling like my heart is not beating fast enough, my lungs not opening enough. Felicity! I look up. Joanna is standing in front of me, her hem splattered with dark sand and her eyes upon the scale in my hand. You tried it? Just a bit. How did you feel? Powerful. She holds out her hand, and I pass her the scale for examination. This is dangerous. She runs her thumb along the smooth edge, then back against the grain. We need to take samples. Sim won't like that, I say. Well, Sim doesn't have to know. She swings her mother's bag off her back and tucks the scale into one of the pockets. Do you think they're different, depending on what part of the body they're taken from? Or are they all the same? How did you get it free? Did you use your hands? I hold up the marlin spike. Good, use that. I'm going to see if there's a way to collect some of the blood. She darts back down the beach, her bag bouncing on her hip, and I set back to the task of wiggling more scales free. I've hardly got the marlin spike wedged under one when someone shouts. I look up, and there's a man running at me, thin and hunched, but moving alarmingly fast. He's shouting in Darija, and I don't understand a word of it, but he's waving his arms like he's trying to shoo me away. I step back, raising my hands, but he keeps coming, now flinging his hand toward the glint of the marlin spike I'm holding. Sim had said run, so I turn and I run. He doesn't follow me far, but I keep going after he stopped and returned to his salvage. There's a stone outcropping on the edge of the inlet, its fanged tops domed with emerald moss. Craggy rocks are scattered at its base, water collecting between them in pools, their sides thick with fluttering sea flora, and a few dotted with bright orange fish. I lose my footing and step up to my knees in the ocean. Something slick and wet brushes my leg, and I shy. To my surprise, whatever brushes me shies too, and lets out a strange cry. It's like a shriek, but registers deeper in my ears than most sounds. My whole body jerks with it. The surface of the water, already puckered from my splash, ripples. I look behind me, but no one on the beach seems to have heard it. It comes again, and I clap my hands over my ears, peering down into the water to see what it is that is screaming at me. I heave myself out of the pool, my petticoats gasping, then crouch down. I touch my hand to the surface, and something presses back from beneath the waves. I fall backward in surprise, sitting straight into one of the thankfully less deep pools and soaking my skirt. There's the sound again, but softer this time, and with more of a purr. Enough to be sure it's coming from this pool. There's a jet of mist, then two nostrils poke above the surface, the slits of skin that keep out water opening as they surface. I scramble back to the edge of the pool, and looking back at me is one of the sea dragons in miniature. Its scales, short nubs, and thin fins poking from its belly, translucent and twirling like ribbon beneath the water. "Joanna!" I shout over my shoulder, so loud that several of the people on the beach turn. Joanna, absorbed in an examination of the dragon teeth, is not one of them. "Joanna!" I shout again, and this time she looks. I make a frantic wave, and she reluctantly detaches herself and trots to my side. The baby dragon pushes its nose against the edges of the pool, trying to hook its head on the rock and hurl itself out. I can see a spot along its neck that's been rubbed raw and bloody from trying. "Oh, oh, oh, don't do that!" I scuttle along the rocks, trying to block the creature from harming itself again. When I touch it, it howls again, and I pull away. Beneath the water, its scales feel like velvet. Joanna, now close enough to hear it too, lets out a shriek of her own as she covers her ears. "What was that?" she calls to me. "Come here," I reply. "There's a little one."
"A what?"
Joanna scrambles to my side, tearing the edge of her skirt on the stones in her haste. She lets out a small gasp when she sees the tiny dragon, its tail thrashing against the confines of the pool, and seizes my arm.
"Felicity!"
"Yes."
"Felicity!"
Her voice is a feather.
"It's..."
"I know."
"A baby."
"Or it could be a pocket variety."
"Felicity."
Both her hands are on my arm now, strangling the fabric of my dress.
"Felicity."
"That's me."
"We have discovered a new species."
Her face is like sunlight on a river, an already resplendent beam made brighter. I don't want to be the cloud and remind her we haven't, though. Sim and her family have sheltered these animals for decades. The scavengers on the beach, the people in Algiers. These dragons are not new to the world, only to our very small part of it. Joanna puts a tentative finger into the water, and the tiny dragon wraps its lips very gently around it, suckling. "It doesn't have teeth," she says, her voice squeaking. "The big one does, but..."
"Oh, no, little one. Is that your mother?"
"How do you know it's a female?" I ask.
"Parental unit of indeterminate gender, then." "Oh, I hope not, you poor thing. We can be orphans together."
It is radical, I think, as I watch Joanna, both of her arms submerged to the elbows as she strokes the dragon's head, the compassion she has for this thing. Most natural philosophers don't carry this sort of tenderness for the things they study. Most doctors don't. The hospitals in London are proof of that. The beetles and lizards and bats hunted for collections and then stuck with pins to a wall behind glass are proof of that. Men want to collect, to compete, to own. Joanna runs a finger along the bridge of the dragon's nose, and a jet of mist shoots from its nostrils as they break the surface. It smells like seaweed and sugar.
"Did you ever think," she says,
as the dragon purrs at her fingertips,
"all those years ago, when we were playing at exploring, that we'd ever actually be here? Or find something like this. This feels like a dream."
She pulls her hand from the water, shaking the water off, then turns to me.
"Do you really think we can keep this to ourselves?
It's not ours to share.
We could take this to the Royal Society.
They'd have to take us seriously with a discovery like this. We could be the first women ever.
First women to do what?
Any of it. All of it. We could lead expeditions, publish books and papers and give lectures, teach at universities. Can't you imagine it? You and me and the sea. She spreads her arms and throws back her head, neck dipped like a dancer's. Maybe it's worth sacrificing a few creatures so that we can better understand them all.
What about sacrificing a few African cities? I reply.
She sighs, letting her arms fall to her sides. The dragon raises its head from the water and nuzzles upward into her palm. It's all very complicated, isn't it? She says. Or is it simply that I am not a good person because I even think that?
I'm not sure anyone is all good when you break us down to raw materials, I say.
Max is all good. Max is a dog. I don't see how that changes anything. He's a good dog.
The sea monster flips in the water, its tail cresting the surface to reveal a small barb like a prickly burr. Joanna flinches with a laugh at the splash.
Maybe this little thing is all good.
Or maybe she'll sink ships one day.
Oh, shush!
She dips her hand again into the water, and the sunlight strikes the waves like the ocean is made of precious stones.
Let me dream that there is something unquestionably pure in this world.
Joanna and I manage to free the little dragon from its prison in the tide pool, but it seems reluctant to swim out into the open ocean. Instead, it keeps darting back to where Joanna and I stand, up to our knees in the ocean, and winding itself between us. Joanna wades out with it, under the pretense of luring it to deeper waters, but it's clear they're both playing. Her skirt bubbles around her like a jellyfish, pulsing with the waves. She chases the tiny dragon through the water, and it lets out another screeching purr, which makes Joanna shriek, though it seems to be a noise of pleasure from deep within them both. She dips a hand into the water, and it comes to her touch, its tail wrapped around her round calf like a living ribbon beneath the sea. I return to the shore, where Joanna's left her mother's bag and folio, and draw a handful of the loose papers from inside. Pages and pages and pages of notes, most that it would take time and a magnifier and less potent sunlight that doesn't butter the lenses of my spectacles to decipher. There are several sheets with drawings of the dragons, each one a little different as she formed a more complete picture of what they look like. There is a long list of chemical compounds with two columns beside them, one with the word obtained dotting it and the second marked with either a P or a G. It reminds me of something, and I dip into my pocket and pull out the list I have been carrying since the hospital in London, now ripped and spotted and practically moulded to the shape of my thigh after so long pressed against it. The only line still completely legible is at the top. I deserve to be here. I'm not sure I believed it when I wrote it. As much as I boasted to a stiff upper lip in the face of rejection, every man who turned me away raised in me a fear that maybe they were right. Maybe I did not deserve a space among them. Maybe there is a reason women are kept in houses, minding children and making supper. Perhaps I never can be half as good a doctor as any of these men, simply because of a natural inferiority, and I am just too stubborn to see that. But if I cannot always believe in myself, I can believe in Joanna, and Sim, and Sybil Glass, and Artemisia Gentileschi, and Sophia Brahe, and Marie Fouquet, and Margaret Cavendish, and every other woman who came before us. I have never doubted the women who came before me, or whether they deserved a seat at the table. I crush the paper in my fist and let the ocean carry it from my fingers and out to sea. I do not need reasons to exist. I do not need to justify the space I take up in this world, not to myself, or Platt, or some hospital governors, or a pirate ship full of men with cutlasses. I have as much claim to this world as anyone else. No one will offer Joanna and me permission to make this work ours, to take up her mother's maps and follow their headings to the horizon's edge, where the sea and the sky smoke together. First of our name, first of our kind. There's a bellow from the cove, and I glance over my shoulder. We're mostly sheltered by the rocks, but a sliver of the beach is still visible to me. The scavengers are leaving. They're leaving fast. They're running up the hillside, their faces turned to the sea so that they lose their footing on the sand. Some of them left their tools and bounty behind in shimmering heaps along the beach. My skin prickles. Something is wrong. I shove Sybil's papers back into the folio, then hike up a handful of my skirt and trek back to the beach, away from the shelter of our cove, so that I have a full view of the empty sea beyond the bay. The sun has travelled farther than I expected. It sits just above the horizon, the yolk of a broken egg tipped out along the edge of the sky. The water is beginning to bronze beneath the spill. And silhouetted against that syrupy sky is a massive warship, sails pulled in, anchor dropped, and longboats lowering into the water. I spring back down the beach and stagger into the cove. Joanna, there's a ship! She looks up from the water.
What? Is it Sims?
I don't think so.
More scavengers?
No, it's a big ship, a warship. If it's European men, they won't let us walk away quietly. At best, we'll be questioned and taken back to the continent. I don't have to say aloud what the worst case is. We have to hide.
Where?
Stay here. Lie low.
We're hardly out of sight here. As soon as they make landfall, they'll spot us, and we'll lead them straight to her.
She glances down at the water, where the dragon pup is twirling between her legs, oblivious to any danger.
Then what do we do? We run. It's the only thing we can do. Get over the dunes and hide there, and wait for Sim, like she said. We have to go now.
Joanna starts to hike toward me, her steps high in the water, but then stops.
No! Stay here!
It takes me a moment to realize she's talking to the sea monster, still curling around her ankles with every step. She tries to shoo it back into the cove, but it's not as well trained as Max.
Stay! Stay here! Don't follow me!
I run through the water, as much as one can run when the waves are pressing you the opposite way and the seafloor keeps abandoning your step, to where Joanna is begging a creature that does not understand her. I splash as loudly as I can, batting the water right in its face. It shimmies away from Joanna with another one of those ear-splitting whines. It is a horrible thing to cause so much fear in something. If it were older and had a few more teeth, it would turn predatory. I know. I felt that sort of fear too. I felt cornered and turned on, and I've bitten back. Instead, the little dragon looks cowed, floating a few feet away from us, its big wet eyes fixed on Joanna, but too scared to return.
I'm sorry, I think. I wish you understood.
But it doesn't, and Joanna and I leave it behind in the cove, frightened and alone with its mother rotting upon the beach. We pull up short at the edge of the rocks, crouching behind them and out of sight of the ship. The longboats have almost reached the shore. The sailors in them are distinctly European, all of them fair-skinned and light-haired and speaking English to one another. They're none of them in any sort of uniform, but they are outfitted with hatchets, and several are hauling cases for collection between them. They drop them on the beach and unfold them into sample boxes, glass jars, vials. Rifles are fired into the air to scare off the few remaining scavengers upon the beach. They all go scrambling for the dunes. The English know about the dragons already. They came here knowing about the beached monster, to harvest it. We're too late.
Do we run for it, I whisper to Joanna as we peer out from our hiding spot. Or do we sneak for it?
I don't think they'll follow us if we run, she says. They just want the area clear. We get up over the hillside and wait for Sim.
There's really no way to sneak. It's scrub and sand and the crumbling cliffs. But if we can get up among the trees, I think we can hide.
Come on!
Joanna and I start to scramble over the rocks. On the beach, the men are so absorbed in their work that it seems a good chance they won't notice us. Then, in the cove behind us, the tiny monster lets out its most ear-splitting scream yet. It stops the world, but only for a moment. The sailors all look straight at us, and Joanna and I both start running. Though running in sand is perhaps the most futile task one can undertake. Joanna is bigger than I am, and with no shoes and her sopping dress weighing her down, she's slower. I almost stop, but there's nothing I can do to help her other than offer words of encouragement, and words never won a race. I had expected the sailors would leave us alone once they saw we were leaving. At most, they'd fire a gunshot in the air. But instead, they're advancing. I was prepared to be chased off, but not to be pursued. Joanna, hurry! But we're pressed against the rocks, the sailors closing in and cutting us off from the path. I try to dodge around one, and he grabs the back of my skirt, yanking me off my feet. I sprawl backward in the sand, and the sailor flips me over, then pins me to the ground with my hands twisted behind me and his knee pressed into my back. I'm spitting out mouthfuls of sand. It's in my eyes and my ears. I kick backward at him, hoping it will land hard enough to weaken his grip. But instead, the marlin spike wedged in my boot flies free and lands in the sand, out of my reach. Another man snatches it up. Joanna screams, and I raise my head as high as I can, just enough to see her hit the ground beside me. Then a heavy boot, black and shiny as a beetle, presses into her back. It is perhaps a very conventionally feminine thing to say, I recognize those shoes. But when the only bit of a man you get a good look at is his footwear, and when that footwear appears again, this time pressing your friend into the dirt, shoes tend to make an impression. I crane my neck to look up at him, though I wouldn't have recognized him, for I never actually got a good look at the man in Platt's living room in Zurich. But I'm certain it's him. He's tall and fair-skinned, his cheeks red with the sun, and hair beneath his cornered hat cut short, like it's usually tucked under a wig.
Alex!
He shouts down the beach, and my heart sinks.
Are these your lost girls?
A shadow stretches up the beach toward us. Beside me, Joanna lets out a whimper. I half expect the little dragon to answer again, their fear matching in pitch. His shadow strikes my face, and I flinch like it burns. Dr. Platt looms over us, a curved cutlass in one hand, and his shirt sleeves already stained with the dragon's blood. He looks ill. His hair is greasy, and his skin like it's one of Quick's waxworks. Perhaps it's the time on the ocean, but the sun tends to lend colour to a man's cheeks, not turn them pallid and bruised.
They are indeed.
He pushes a toe under Joanna's chin and tips her face up to his.
I had a sense we might cross paths here.
How did you find us? I ask, and it comes out with a mouthful of sand. Platt spins to face me, his feet tipping as the sand caves under them.
We followed the monster.
I remember the wound on its side, the ripped-up flesh around its neck, like something from a harpoon.
You killed it!
Platt doesn't answer. Instead, he turns to the man with the boots and says,
"Do we tie them up?"
"Probably best while we harvest."
"Harvest?"
Joanna cries. And while we had just considered taking samples ourselves,
These men look ready to extract far more. Platt doesn't acknowledge her. Instead, he says to his sailors,
"Bind them together. We'll take them back to the ship when we're done here."
I want to scream. I want to spit and writhe and kick my feet like a child. This pathetic, deceptive man I wasted years of my life idolizing, followed across a continent on a chance, who had his knife so deep in my side I didn't feel it until he twisted. I've never wanted so badly to punch someone in the face as I do him in this moment. Where are Sim and all those threatening pirates when we need them? As much as I believe in the power and strength of a woman, what I wouldn't give for a flock of barrel-chested men with cutlasses for limbs to emerge from the hilltops and leap to our defence. But instead, Joanna and I are bound back to back, our wrists knotted to each other and legs tied at the ankles and knees, with a length of coarse cloth looped around each of our mouths. We are then made to sit and watch as the sea dragon is stripped of its scales in chunks that scatter along the beach like shells. Even after they've been collected, they leave dark circles of blood in the sand. The sailors work long into the night. They light fires, burn the fat from the leviathan body for fuel. The men take turns standing watch over us. Joanna is facing the ocean. I have my back to the sailors, looking up at the tops of the cliffs. So it's me who sees the pirates when they appear at the top of the hillside, dark silhouettes that feather from the shrubbery and spread. The moonlight makes their weapons look like they're made of smoke. Me who sees Sim creep to the edge, the same spot we three stood this morning, and hold up a hand, watching Joanna and me and the English sailors and the ship, calling a halt, and then a retreat. I'm the one who watches them disappear into the darkness, leaving us tied on the beach as Platt's men strip the dragon to its bones. 18. We are kept upon the beach until the sun rises and the men begin to load their spoils onto the longboats to be ferried back to the ship. The carcass of the monster is rotten flesh and raw bones now, the remaining skin pinked and bloody and bare. It looks like a vein burst open upon the shore. Joanna and I are unbound from each other, and hauled into the last longboat, then forced to sit wedged on the floor between cutlasses and hatchets, their blades clinking together like coins in a purse. We've hardly cast off before my socks and skirt are soaked through with the blood and bile collecting in the bottom of the boat. The sailors stink of the rotten entrails they've been picking apart, all of them punchy from whatever they've been chewing to keep themselves awake, and popping blisters upon their palms from where their work has rubbed them raw. I could tell them that will lead to nothing but infection, but at this moment I'd prefer if all their hands fester and rot off. Any man who takes a lady against her will deserves a far more sensitive body part than the hands to drop off slowly. As our boat is hauled up to the deck, I catch a glimpse of the name painted upon the side. Kottenkvad, Dutch or Germanic, and though I couldn't say which, I'm certain it's a ship from Joanna's uncle's fleet. We are marched to the captain's cabin at the back of the ship, where we are at last untied and ungagged. My tongue feels hairy and dry after so long pressed against the thick material. Beside me, Joanna sucks in her cheeks, trying to generate moisture in her mouth. Platt is waiting for us in the cabin, leaning against the captain's desk like it's holding him up. His eyes are bloodshot, his skin even yellower than it looked on the beach. Before him is Joanna's trunk, left behind at Frau Engel's in Zurich. He must have tracked her there, same as I had, and I say a quick prayer of thanks that we didn't spend another night there before we left.
a prayer rendered pointless by the fact that he's caught us now. He also has Sybil Glass's bag and the leather portfolio collected from the beach. The bag has been ripped apart, emptied, and then turned inside out so that its contents are strewn across the floor. The papers have been far more civilly looted, leafed through, and left lying in stacks upon the desktop. Joanna and I both stop as the cabin door slams at our backs, the trunk in between us and Platt.
"Where's the map, Joanna?"
he demands with no prelude.
"What map?"
she says, really leaning into that girlish trill of her voice. The pitch could shatter glass.
"Your goddamn mother's goddamn map! Where is it?"
Platt pushes himself up and staggers around the trunk. I'm not entirely sure what the answer is. I didn't see the map when I flipped through the folio earlier, but I had assumed it was there. Either Joanna had taken precautions, or it had been lost somewhere along the way, though that seems impossible. I think briefly of Sim, seeing her lurking upon the top of the hill, watching the English ravage the dragons they'd sworn to protect. Perhaps she had taken the map without us noticing, and all these noble intentions had been a lie, or rather, more of a lie than previously thought, for no matter her motives, she had still abandoned us. Platt kicks the trunk out of his way, and Joanna takes a step back, straight onto my foot. I grab her by the elbow and push her behind me, putting myself between her and Platt.
"We don't know what you're talking about," I say.
My voice is hoarse after a night with my mouth full of wool, but at least that disguises the fear that would have dried it out anyway.
"I know you have it,"
Platt says. His legs tremble under him, the ship's bobbing in the water seeming to unsettle him more than it should.
"You've every other damn thing she left behind on that ship. You wouldn't have left Zurich without it. You wouldn't be here if you didn't have it."
He picks up the portfolio case and shakes it at us. He's already emptied it, so it is a gesture made primarily for symbolism.
"Where is the map?"
"We left it behind," Joanna says.
She has her elbows pulled into her, hands balled over her stomach.
"It's back in Algiers."
Platt's eyes flash with panic, but then he swallows hard.
"You're lying. You wouldn't go all the way to Africa to leave it behind. Did you meet with someone? Did you sell it? Did those pirates make a deal with you?"
"How do you know about the pirates?" I ask.
He laughs, a savage roar sound.
"Because the Crown and Cleaver owns every inch of water we sailed in. We were paying them taxes just to be allowed into their territory. And her mother,"
and here he thrusts a shaking finger at Joanna,
"used the voyage for her own gain. She was mapping her way to these monsters' nests, and then she was going to take that information to return to England and make a name for herself. If she hadn't been certain this discovery would make her impossible to ignore, she wouldn't have cared about these beasties. Miss Sybil Glass would have done anything for attention."
"So how are you any different?" I shoot back. "You can't claim noble intentions either after you just stripped a corpse."
"For resources," he replies,
his jaw clenched around the final word.
"Resources that the corsairs who own that land would have let wash back out to sea and waste. They rob the world of valuable substances by keeping them hidden."
He's groping around in his coat. He looks manic and wild, his hands shaking as he paws for his snuff box in his inside pocket. But when he flicks it open, it's empty. He lets out a low growl and instead takes up the rolled leather case fallen from Sybil's bag and unfurls it, fumbling for one of the vials of powdered scale. The back of my mouth burns at the sight of that glistening powder, my lungs suddenly very aware of how light my breath is, how much stronger than me Platt is. I want to reach out and snatch it from him, but instead I say,
"Don't take that! It's addictive!"
"You think I don't know that?" he snaps. Not all of us are born as privileged as you, Miss Montague. We don't learn about addicts in our medical treatises. We are born to them and raised by them, and we're hooked from the moment we first breathe.
That's what you've been taking all this time, I say. It's not snuff or madak or opium. It's those scales. His hand fists around the vial so tight his knuckles turn white. I'm shocked it doesn't break.
Your mother, he says, jerking his head towards Joanna, roped me into her experiments. Poison and antidote and poison and antidote, all treated with the powdered scales she found in black markets and bought off pirates. She told me it was a drug that could end sickness, asked me to take it regularly, and promised it would get me off opium. Said I could go back to England a sober man and get my medical license back, and she'd credit me for my help. It was a wreck of a ship. A damned voyage paid for as cheaply as possible by that man who wanted a collection but had no idea the lengths it took to get one. We were all sick from the rot and the rats and the food. We thought we'd sink before we got to the Barbary States. Every man on board that boat was only there because he had no other options. Your mother was no different.
No one wanted to work with her because she was a woman, Joanna argues.
No one wanted to work with her because she was a bitch, Platt says, and Joanna cringes. She used anyone who could give her a step up, used them and then discarded them.
She had to fight for recognition, Joanna says. You're the one who took credit for her work in the cabinet.
It was my work, too. It ruined my whole damn life. And if she hadn't gotten herself killed, she wouldn't have given me an inch, he replies. Your mother was ruthless, just as much of a degenerate addict as I am. She was a slave of her ambition, and that made her a slave of her drug.
He can't get the seal broken on the vial, and with a growl of frustration, he cracks the top off against the edge of the desk and empties it into his hand. Don't! I grab his hand, and the powder spills, blossoming in a cloud between us before settling upon the desk, the floor, down the front of both our clothes. No speck salvageable. I look up at Platt, just as his hand connects with the side of my face. It's a stunning pain, unlike anything I've ever experienced. The bright sting reverberates through me. My vision goes blurry and I stumble backward, sitting down so hard that I feel the shudder through every inch of my spine and popping in my neck. Joanna shrieks. I blink hard, trying to clear my vision and the ringing in my ears.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry,
Platt is saying, his voice ragged and breaking. He's bent over the desk, his shoulders shaking.
I didn't mean to...
You've lost your mind, Joanna shouts at him. There's a knock on the cabin door. Then the man who visited Platt in Zurich enters.
What the hell is going on here?
He snaps, pushing the door shut behind him with one of those expensive boots, their toes speckled with sand from the beach.
We're loaded, and we need a heading. Good God, Alex!
Platt motions wordlessly to the gent, and the two of them stagger out onto the deck, the door clapping shut behind them. As soon as Platt is gone, Joanna is beside me. Are you all right? She asks, brushing away the tears the slap pried from my eyes with a gentle touch that still stings. Soons, I can see his whole handprint on your face.
It's fine.
I spit out a mouthful of blood from biting my tongue, but all my teeth are still in my head, and a quick exploration of my face with my fingers confirms no bones broken. Outside the door, I can hear Platt and the other man arguing. Forcing myself to ignore the pain, I motion to the door, and Joanna and I both crawl forward and press our ears to it.
"Losing your head," the man is saying. "Where's the map?"
"She has it," Fitz, Platt replies, his voice cracking. "I know she does."
"But you haven't seen it."
"I... no."
"Is it stashed somewhere on the beach, or back in the city. We have to take her back to England and then to court. They'll force her to surrender. We don't have time to return to England and get a court to pry documents out of her hands, Fitz snaps. Without a marriage certificate, your legal claim is tenuous at best, and by the time a judge has heard your case, you'll not have any